thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom. Welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Professor David Henkin, author of The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. We are nearing the end of the secular year 2021, which always leads to best of lists for the 12 months that have just passed. While we still have one more Too Jewish show next Sunday, don't miss it, which will be the actual final show of 2021. And while the Jewish year truly began with Rosh Hashanah back in September, I've never been able to resist joining in as we approach the end of December with end-of-the-year secular year lists of the biggest Jewish news stories of the past 12 months. There's just something about Jewish best-of and worst-of lists that draws me in like a moth to a flame, or perhaps like a minion-goer to pickled herring. I have this irresistible desire to tabulate what really mattered and what was good and bad over the past year. But unlike Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year for the soul in the fall, there is no real guilt associated with the ending of the secular year. No need to probe our own conduct, see how we can improve in the year to come. These 2021 best and worst of Jewish lists are just a good thing to talk about and argue about. Two things we Jews do as well as any group on the planet. And so, for this week's show, I'll start the counting with a Too Jewish top 10 list of the biggest Jewish news stories of 2021. Number 10, Paul Rudd was named Sexiest Man Alive by People magazine, only the second fully Jewish guy to be so named, after Adam Levine of Maroon 5 a few years ago. Two partially Jewish men, David Beckham and Harrison Ford, won the magazine honor some years back. Number 9, Zebulon Simintov, the last Jew in Afghanistan, finally left after the Taliban takeover of that troubled country following the U.S. withdrawal. Simintov had outlasted the entire Jewish community, which dated back thousands of years. Number 8, actress, PhD biologist, and past Too Jewish guest Mayim Bialik became at least partial host of the long-running TV show Jeopardy. Number 7, we lost some great Jews last year. Ed Asner, who died at the age of 91, a great actor and activist and past guest of Too Jewish on multiple occasions. The magnificent Broadway composer and lyricist, Stephen Sondheim. Rabbi Richard Hirsch, longtime head of the World Union of Progressive Judaism. Actor Charles Grodin. Rock musician and composer Jim Steinman. Jazz pianist and songwriter Dave Frischberg. Opera conductor James Levine. Author Norton Juster of The Phantom Tollbooth, Herschel Shanks of Biblical Archaeology Review and Moment Magazine, talk show royalty Larry King, mega donor Sheldon Adelson, Broadway producer Roger Berlind, and some Philo Semites, friends of Israel and the Jews, like Prince Philip of Great Britain. Number 6, Israeli Olympians won 2 gold medals and 2 bronze in Tokyo, best showing yet for the Jewish state in the Summer Olympics. And the Olympics finally held a moment of silence, officially recognizing the 11 Israeli Olympians murdered in 1972 in Munich by Palestinian terrorists. Number 5, Isaac Herzog was named the new president of Israel, a ceremonial but important and influential position, replacing the outstanding retiring president, Reuven Rivlin. Number 4, Hamas launched 5,000 rockets at Israel during the 12-day war between Israel and the Palestinian terrorists controlling Gaza back in May. After a nasty war conducted almost entirely from above, Hamas launched unaimed rockets that forced many Israelis into bomb shelters and destroyed homes and cars and buildings and killed people. Israel countered with artillery, targeted missiles, and aerial bombings to destroy Hamas's military capacity. Well, after that, a ceasefire ended the conflict. The war began after the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank under Mahmoud Abbas again canceled elections for, like, I don't know, a decade and a half, provoking its enemies, Hamas, to assert their leadership of the Palestinian world through their favorite method, violence against Jewish civilians. Number three, anti-Semitic attacks took place all around the world in 2021, including Los Angeles, Boston, New York, London, Paris, and Madrid, as well as right here in Tucson, Arizona, where I live, in response to the Gaza war. In addition, the January 6th Trumpian insurrection and attack on the U.S. Capitol included white supremacists and men wearing anti-Semitic signs and t-shirts like Camp Auschwitz. Number two, the changing of the guard, finally. The removal of Bibi Netanyahu as Prime Minister of Israel back in June after a full 10 years as head of government, and his replacement after a decade by Naftali Bennett as the new Prime Minister of Israel. And number one, the number one Jewish news story of 2021, what else could it be? Israel led the world as vaccination nation by quickly and effectively inoculating its population against coronavirus, proactively preparing and purchasing Pfizer vaccines, moving more rapidly and effectively than any other nation to protect its citizens against the pandemic. And two key players in the development of the vaccine, Albert Bourla of Pfizer and Tal Zaks of Moderna, were instrumental in creating the two most effective shots against COVID-19 and its variants. Okay, 2021 wasn't a great year for many people, but it definitely seemed better than 2020, and we have high hopes for 2022. We are looking to sing new songs in 2022 for sure, and so to play us in this morning, here's a new setting of Psalm 149, Sing to the Lord a New Song, by a group called Mikedem, from their debut album.
Shirun l'Adonai, shir chadash, teilato bikal chasidi, yismach Yisrael b'asar. בני ציון יגילו ומלכם יהללו שמו ומחול ותופך עינו יזמו לו, יזמו לו יהללו שמו ומחול ותופך עינו יזמו לו רוצה אדוני בעמו יפאר ענבים בישועה יעלזו חסידים בכבוד ירננו על משכבותם ויעללו שמו ומחול בתופך עינו יזמו לו, יזמו לו יעללו שמו ומחול ותופך עינו יזמרו לו יעללו שמו ומחול ותופך עינו יזמרו לו, יזמרו לו יעללו שמו ומחול ותופך עינו יזמרו לו
That was Mikedem singing Sing to the Lord a New Song, Shiru L'Adonai, Shir Chadash. When we return on To Jewish in a moment, our guest, Professor David Henkin, will explain just how odd the seven-day week really is and how it got that way. He's the author of The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are, and he'll join us when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Professor David Henkin is the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at UC Berkeley. He's written a number of books, including The Postal Age, City Reading, and Becoming America, History for the 21st Century. He lives in San Francisco and Bozeman, two places I like very much. And he has a new book that has nothing to do with any of that called The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi. Nice to be here.
So tell us what prompted you to write about the oddity of the seven-day week.
Well, I'd say ultimately my curiosity about the oddity of the seven-day week goes back to childhood. I grew up in a traditionally observant Jewish home. The week had all kinds of meanings and implications and disciplinary force in my life. But I noticed that the rest of the world that was otherwise indifferent to the practices that structured those of mine and my family, the rest of the world also seemed to care about the week. And as I got older, I realized there was nothing natural about the week. And as I got even older, it also wasn't actually universal. That many parts of the world didn't have a week. So I've always been very interested in it. And there was a sort of well-known book written just over 30 years ago by a sociologist named Eviatar Zerubbabel that speaks about this and definitely shaped my thinking about it. But I decided to try to figure out how and when and why exactly we came to exert the force it does in the modern world. Because the week has done many things for many different societies. Most famously, it has been used to divide labor and leisure, or to divide profane and sacred time. But I notice that in the world I live in, we all live in the week. There's many other things too. It divides one day from the next day, even when they're both weekdays. It's used to lump time together to talk about what we did this week, we did last week, and that our Tuesdays and our Wednesdays and our Thursdays have a kind of distinct feel to them that seems not fully explainable when they're talking about labor or religion. So I decided to go into the time period that I spent most of my life studying, the first half of the 19th century, try to figure out what it actually meant in the 19th century to notice the week, whether people knew what day of the week it was, what anchored them to the week, and what kinds of implications it had for their lives. They were so oriented to this one peculiar artificial calendar that really doesn't fit into any other large time unit and is not confirmable in the natural world.
We will talk much more with Professor David Henkin about his book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are, because most of our other time frames turn out to be connected to the natural world, but not the week, not the Shabbat-oriented week. Anyway, we'll come back to that in just a moment here on Two Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a newish Jewish synagogue in the Northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely but in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Again, join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning, or come on Facebook. We have our Facebook Live Shabbat evening celebration services Friday night at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study at 9 a.m., all with me leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services are in person and virtual. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are in person, live, and on Zoom. You can access those by going to our website or emailing me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. And don't miss our special December 25th day, a great Shabbat, Torah study, services, a hike, and then Chinese food and the wonderful movie The Frisco Kid with Rabbi Baruch Kohan, who taught Gene Wilder how to daven for that film. Anyway, join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest, most exciting, and fastest-growing Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Until December 31st, 2021, get additional holiday savings off 2021 prices. Avoid inflation. Save your family additional costs down the road. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about anti-Semitism in France because it's been much in the news, and we covered first the Catholic origin anti-Semitism of the Middle Ages. It lasted really till 1789, and then the 19th century anti-Semitism, a result of Jews moving into the professions they'd been barred from and creating competition, and suddenly up out of the earth, the soil, rises this new form of anti-Semitism, not just in France, of course, but all over Western Europe and Eastern Europe, I suppose, too, Central Europe anyway. The 20th century anti-Semitism and the 21st century anti-Semitism in France, however, comes from a very different source. Maybe you can address that today.
Yeah, I think it's important not to overlook this, and I think there are very few of our compatriots here in the U.S. who even begin to understand this interlinked phenomenon. This is an anti-Semitism that didn't appear in France until long after World War II. I would say until after 1960, in fact. So after the Israeli War of Independence, after the Suez War, and this is a kind of imported anti-Semitism that arrived in France with immigrants from Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia, by and large, which had all been French colonies and which all had tremendous populations of, first of all, French Jews who had French citizenship, and second of all, Muslims, some of whom had French citizenship and some did not, and the French kept changing the rules on these people, they tended to move to France later than the Jews did. A lot of Jews left as a result of the War of Independence in Israel in 48-49, and another big wave came in the late 50s as a result of the Suez War and increasing local hostility toward the remaining Jewish populations. So these Jews flooded France, particularly the South, but even Paris has now large communities of North African Jews. But later, and particularly following the French defeat in Algeria, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Algerian Muslims came and settled in France. And for the French, absorbing these people was always a problem. The French were the creators, after all, of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and they believed in welcoming refugees, and they thought they had a liberal society, this, that, and the other thing. But they were horribly traumatized by the long war in Algeria, from which they emerged a loser, but in which they lost a lot of lives and a lot of their national pride and honor. And as much as in the 50s and 60s and even 70s, the French were still obsessed with who collaborated with the Nazis during World War II and who was truly a resistant and who was a hero and who was a villain, that trauma began to be displaced by who is to blame for the loss of Algeria, and how do we deal with this? And it's still almost a taboo subject in polite society in France. I mean, this is more than 50 years later. This is such a deep wound and trauma that the French really can't talk about it. But most of the perpetrators of horrible anti-Semitic acts that make the front pages of the newspapers these days and for the past decade or even two decades are outrages committed by North African Muslims who happen to live in France, who are dissatisfied with many things, most of which have nothing to do with Jews. But the easiest targets for them are little old ladies, like Holocaust survivors.
Yeah, horrific acts.
In their late 80s, who they pick up in their apartments and throw off balconies and smash them into the street.
Or murder and then light the apartment on fire.
Right. Really brutal, horrible, individual things. aimed at Jews, but also aimed at expressing their anger at what they feel is a lack of acceptance and a lack of opportunity in French society. So it's a broad and deep social problem, at the bottom of which lies France's apparent inability to deal with the loss of Algeria.
Yeah, fascinating. Not cheerful, but fascinating. Thanks so much, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for an occasionally recurring feature of Too Jewish, our most serene Zen Judaism segment, a return of haikus for Jews. For you, a little enlightenment. The Shiva visit. So sorry about your loss. Now, back to my problems. And 7-foot Jews in the NBA slam dunking. My alarm clock rings. Those were haikus for Jews, our Zen Judaism segment, koans, just for you. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Yitzchak was not the kind of person you could expect any sympathy from. Whenever something bad happened to anyone, he would shrug his shoulders and say, "Well, look on the bright side. It could have been worse." One day, something truly terrible happened to the married couple living next door to Yitzchak. The husband came home early from work, caught his wife in bed with another man. He shot both his wife and her lover, and then killed himself. Crowds gathered in the street. Many were in a state of shock. As usual, Yitzchak just shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, look on the bright side. It could have been worse." His neighbors recoiled in horror. "Don't be so stupid," they told him. "How on earth could it have been any worse?" And Yitzchak replied, "Well, if the husband had come home early yesterday, I would be dead now." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week, we start reading Exodus, second book of the Torah, with the extraordinary Torah portion of Shmot, one of the greatest sections of all. It begins with a coda on Genesis, recounting how the first family of Genesis, Bereshit, made up of Jacob and his many sons and their descendants, all moved down to Egypt, where Joseph was the effective ruler of the country. They settled in Goshen in the northeast corner of Egypt and flourished there in the Nile Delta. And then the fateful events that set up the future of our people begin. Joseph and his generation all pass away. A new dynasty takes over in Egypt, which doesn't remember Joseph and his contributions, and the Israelites are viewed differently. As they grow in numbers and wealth, the new pharaoh worries. The immigrants might serve as a fifth column in the event of invasion. They speak a different language, worship a different god. Their hair is curlier, their noses perhaps larger, their skin a bit darker. They certainly have funny accents. They look like trouble. Isn't it interesting how history is a way of repeating itself? How the same negative stereotypes and wicked ways of looking at immigrants recur? And so the Egyptians enslave the Israelites, putting them to work as unpaid slave labor, building store cities, not pyramids, for the royal government. They set up overseers, taskmasters, establish work quotas, push them harder and harder, try literally to work them to death. When that fails, the Hebrews are tougher than the Egyptians expected, they decide to kill all the male babies, eliminating the whole masculine population in one generation. But the Jews are too crafty for their oppressors. In the tribe of Levi, a woman hides her newborn boy baby until his cries are too loud to be stifled. She puts him into a tiny ark, a new Noah, and sets him a sail in the Nile River. When the Pharaoh's daughter pulls him from the river and names him Moses, a remarkable personal story is truly begun. Shmot tells of the early life and adolescence of Moses, his instinctive outrage at injustice, his hot temper, his exile to the Sinai. It shows him maturing, marrying, fathering children in the desert. And then it takes him through the dramatic narrative of the burning bush, an encounter with the commanding God that will bring him back into the crucible of history and lead him to become the greatest liberator the world has ever known. Finally, it returns Moses to Egypt to meet his brother Aaron and shape his destiny and ours. There is almost too much in this portion to grasp, encapsulating as it does so many of the formative tales of our people's religious history. Most importantly, unlike so many hero stories of other traditions, Exodus does not make Moses into a god or even into a perfect human paragon. He is just a man, a great, flawed man, born into a conflict not of his own making, rising to greatness through trial and error, learning both how to follow God and how to lead people towards justice and freedom. It's a great story, but more than that, it is a powerful lesson. Moses became the model for every truly great Jewish leader thereafter because of his very humanness, his ability to empathize with the suffering of the downtrodden, utilize the power of righteousness to accomplish, well, everything. May we come to understand as well that we can accomplish great things too if we choose, in spite of our own imperfections and limitations. We can successfully fight for justice, freedom, and truth. When we come back, our guest, Professor David Henkin, explains why a 30-day month and a 365-day year make perfect sense, but a 7-day week really doesn't. How that came to be and what happens when we try to change it, and much more. All will return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett met with Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, the crown prince and leader of the United Arab Emirates, last week, marking the first time an Israeli prime minister has visited the UAE. The trip was announced by Bennett's office just a couple of hours before he flew to the Gulf country. It's not a long flight. Bennett was greeted upon his arrival by the UAE's foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed, and stayed overnight before meeting the crown prince at his Abu Dhabi palace. The two leaders discussed shared interests around Iran and economic cooperation. The visit comes as both Israel and the Emirates have expressed concerns about Iran's nuclear program, and over a year after the countries signed the Abraham Accords and began diplomatic relations. Bennett said Israelis and Emiratis were neighbors and cousins and the grandchildren of the prophet Abraham. The relations between our two countries have strengthened in all fields, and I am very satisfied, as many cooperation agreements were concluded in the fields of trade, research and development, and cybersecurity, health, education, aviation, and more. I look forward to the continued development and consolidation of relations, Bennett added. In less sanguine news, a story emerged last week that, according to Barak Ravid, author of a new book published about the Abraham Accords, Donald Trump was very offended when Bibi Netanyahu congratulated Joe Biden for winning the 2020 presidential election. Trump claimed Netanyahu was one of the first world leaders to congratulate Biden on winning the presidency, though Netanyahu actually waited over 12 hours after the election to congratulate Biden. "I haven't spoken to him since," Trump said of Netanyahu in his interview with Barak Ravid. "F him." In another interview with Ravid back in July, Trump suggested Netanyahu's congratulatory video call to Biden hurt him badly with the people of Israel. Netanyahu is currently head of opposition in the Knesset. "As you know, I'm very popular in Israel," Trump said. "I think it hurt him very badly." Trump said he found Netanyahu less interested in making peace than he'd originally hoped. "Bibi did not want to make a deal," Trump said of Netanyahu. That, of course, is not a surprise to anyone who has followed Israeli and Palestinian politics for the last decade. In happier and more interesting news, when she won the privilege of representing Puerto Rico in the Miss Universe contest, Michelle Marie Colon spoke of her pride in making history as the first black woman from Puerto Rico to seize the honor. But this week in Israel, where the Miss Universe contest is being held in Eilat, she had been touting pride in another aspect of her heritage, her Jewish great-grandfather who escaped the Holocaust. Last week, Cologne posted a photo holding hands with Noah Kochva, the Israeli entrance into the contest, beneath a wall covered with portraits of the victims of the Holocaust at Yad Vashem. My great-grandfather, Rodolfo Cohn, was a survivor of the Holocaust, Cologne wrote. He moved to the Caribbean and met Doria Thomas, my great-grandmother, an empowered Afro-Caribbean woman, descendant of slaves, who was the administrator of a farm. Together, they formed a solid family full of love, built upon empathy and resilience. Cologne told the story in an impromptu talk while the contestants toured Yad Vashem. Danny Dayan, Yad Vashem's memorial chairman, posted a video on Twitter, and it soon went viral. I came here to Israel knowing I would be more connected to my family because my grandfather actually escaped from the Holocaust, and all of his other family members, sisters, brothers, even their daughters, four daughters, were killed, especially in Auschwitz, Cologne said. Dayan said Cologne, a 21-year-old pre-med student, surprised her fellow Miss Universe contestants. Cologne's comments came at a time when advocates had tried to turn the pageant in Eilat into a political referendum against Israel. Palestinians called for contestants to boycott the competition, but only Malaysia and Indonesia did so. Meanwhile, South Africa's contestant attended, despite pressure from the South African government to boycott Israel. In addition, this year's competition, the Miss Universe competition, featured a contestant from the United Arab Emirates for the first time and a contestant from Morocco for the first time in decades. Both of those countries signed diplomatic normalization agreements with Israel in 2020. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Until December 31st, 2021, get additional holiday savings off 2021 prices. Avoid inflation. Save your family additional costs down the road. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor David Henkin, who has written a number of interesting books, has a new one out, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. He's the Margaret Byrne Professor of History at UC Berkeley. The way that we calculate a year or a month, those kind of fit with the natural rhythms of life. The week doesn't. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, yes. I mean, the year more obviously is intended to approximate a revolution around the sun. Our months in the Gregorian calendar are a little different. They don't actually correspond to anything in the natural world, and we know that they're sort of arbitrary because they're not even the same length as one another. But certainly, we can tell that they are rooted in lunar cycles. That the idea of a month of time is at least suggested by the fact that that a lunar cycle is a little over 29 days.
Yeah, and they clearly must have been derived from all the lunar calendars, like the Jewish calendar, the Chinese calendar, all the earliest calendars seem to have been lunar.
Yeah. Right. I mean, we don't really know of any society that's been indifferent to the moon. It's just that our calendar reflects that, so to speak, in a very indirect way. But the week is not even really suggested by anything in nature. I mean, people have argued or speculated that it might be suggested as a fraction of a lunar cycle, as a fraction of a menstrual cycle, as having something to do with the observable world. But those hypotheses don't really hold up to scrutiny, and they don't make sense of the fact that many parts of the world, for most of their history, had no seven-day cycle at all. And even some of the ones that didn't really use it as extensively as we do. I mean, I would say even that's even true in the Jewish tradition. If you begin with the Bible, the week is not actually used as a dating system in the Hebrew Bible in the Tanakh. I mean, certainly it is suggested by the prohibitions on Sabbath work, which requires that you at least try to keep track of a seven-day cycle, but there's little sense in the Hebrew Bible that people mark time by noting what day of the week it was or what week of the year it was.
In your book, you go back to the beginning of the 19th century, which is, you know, in some ways the modern world begins with the 19th century. You could make that case. Right. At least in the West. Tell us about how the week evolved, because, you know, the weekend used to be one day. Now, it's more complicated than that. I'll let you tell the story.
Right, okay. So, I mean, in some ways, the United States was already a very unusually week-oriented society, even in 1800, and that British North America was already a relatively week-oriented society, even in 1700. But the week was largely used simply to distinguish Sunday from other days. In other words, it was a very prominent calendar for people, English-speaking people living in North America, but it was not a calendar that required people to pay too much attention to whether it was Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday. Now, it's true that some things about the weekend would change in the 19th century, but I'm arguing that a different kind of change took place even earlier and was more significant, which was that people began to really have different experiences of the different days of the week. And that was because they had many, many more activities, both in their working lives and especially in their leisure lives, that were pegged to particular days in the weekly cycle. So things like going to the theater, or housekeeping routines and rituals, or reading of newspapers, or the arrival of mail, various kinds of commercial activities, all of these things became pegged to particular days of the week and made it much more important to know whether it was Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday, and also gave those days a distinctive feel. And that's an aspect of weekly life that I think is peculiarly modern. In other words, the week is a very ancient timekeeping technology, but it's really only in the modern world that we have the following phenomenon. You think it's Tuesday, and suddenly you realize you're wrong. It's Wednesday. And it's a singular symptom of temporal disorientation. It's often regarded even as a symptom of cognitive decline or cognitive failure. In a way that this isn't true for other time units. If you think that today is the 24th and it turns out to be the 23rd, I mean, that might cause you some embarrassment if you forget someone's birthday in your life, or it might be significant if you have a deadline. But for most of the time, we don't really even know what day of the month it is. It just isn't that important, and it doesn't sort of it doesn't anchor our memory and our sense of being in the world the way the week does. So I'm trying to trace the origins of that, and it's really that aspect of the week that I think became part of the experience of ordinary people in the United States during the first half of the 19th century.
So moving from that first half of the 19th century, not to take a quantum leap or anything in time, for example, the whole idea of the week really comes from a religious background, right? I mean, that's sort of the conclusion you make.
Yeah, I mean, it does have two separate origins. One is what you're implying, which is the dominical week or the Sabbath week. The idea that there is a both a religious explanation for the origin of the week, which is that it's rooted in the creation of the world or the resurrection of Jesus or something like that, and a religious injunction to keep the week. By observing the Sabbath. So that's one tradition. The other one is in some ways a weaker tradition, but it's had a huge impact, and that was the idea that there are seven celestial bodies that rotate in their dominion over the world. So the sun and the moon and the five observable planets from Earth form a kind of septet that rotates over time. And the best evidence for the origin of this planetary week is from the Western Mediterranean, especially from the Italian peninsula, and it really sort of took hold in ancient Rome. Ancient Rome, of course, was also where Jewish and Christian religious practices became spread to a larger world, and so I would say that these two traditions, the planetary week and the Sabbath week, converged in ancient Rome, and both have left their mark on our experience of the week. The Sabbath week more prominently, but the planetary astrological week is still part of the legacy of 7-day timekeeping. The most obvious, though may seem a little superficial, evidence of it is the names of the days of the week themselves in most Indo-European languages correspond to the planet or the god associated with that planet. So, for example, today is Wednesday, which is the day of Mercury, and in most Indo-European languages, that's how we label today. Tomorrow will be Thursday, the day of Thor, day of Jupiter. That is the day of the dominion of the planet Jupiter, or the god of Jupiter. So there are traces of the astrological week. And so far as we know, the astrological week and the Sabbath week are really separate origins. This has been debated a little bit by historians and anthropologists, but I think the best evidence suggests that those have separate origins.
There have been attempts to change this from the seven-day week. I think maybe most famously the French Revolution, which for a while tried to create 3 10-day weeks in a month to create some greater regularity, and then at the end of the year they had 2 throw-a-week. Can you explain what they tried to do and why that didn't work?
Yeah, so that is the most famous, but maybe it's also famously unsuccessful attempt to change the week. The French revolutionaries were trying to rationalize time, and 10 struck them as a much more reasonable base number for a calendar, for obvious reasons, and this is how we get metric system as well. So that's part of it. It was an attempt to make the week more rational and make calendars more rational, but it was also an attempt to stamp out the power of the Catholic Church in French society. The French revolutionaries understood that their big enemy was the Catholic Church, and if they thought if we can get rid of this calendar upon which the Church depends, we can actually remove religion, remove Christianity from the mental maps of the population. And I would say that's probably the reason it failed, is because Catholicism really did still enjoy widespread popularity and adherence, and also because the mental maps that the Christianity had produced over time with the seven-day week were difficult to shake. The Soviets also experimented with changing the weekly cycle. They did two things. First of all, they tried to shorten it And then they also tried to stagger it, in other words, to make it an uncoordinated week so that this was at that point a six-day cycle. They would say one-sixth of the population gets their day off on day one, and another sixth gets it off on day two, et cetera. And that was, again, also supposed to weaken the power of the Russian Orthodox Church. But I would say the reason that that failed probably had more to do with opposition, even among secular-minded supporters of the Bolsheviks, opposition to having an uncoordinated weekend. In other words, by the 1920s, the experience of the week was such that people expected to have the same weekly calendar as their neighbors, as their friends, and as strangers. So to me, that reflects a big difference between the revolution in France and the revolution in Russia, which is by the time you get to the Soviet period, it is much more broadly understood that the week is a calendar for coordinating the activities and not simply a calendar for enforcing religious observances.
I want to thank David Henkin for a great visit here on Too Jewish. His book, you can just look for The Week, right? Can't you to find you?
Yeah.
Where can people go to find out more about you and find out more about your work?
Well, I do have a brand new website called theweekahistory.com. The book is available in bookstores. I believe in Tucson and certainly lots of other places. And, of course, it's available on bookshop.org and Barnes & Noble, and even Amazon.
And even Amazon, where everything can be purchased. Yeah. David, thank you so much.
Rabbi, nice to talk to you.
We will hear about next week's guests, get a final musical play when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest on the final show of 2021 will be Stephen Schwartz, author of the excellent new novel, The Tenderest of Strings. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, all starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush. And coming up Saturday, December 25th, we have a very special day planned. In addition to Shabbat morning Torah study and services, we have a Shabbat afternoon hike. And coming up December 25th, we have a very special Shabbat day planned. In addition to Shabbat morning Torah study and services, we have a Shabbat afternoon hike and service at Honeybee, and Saturday night of Chinese food, Havdalah, and the showing of the wonderful film, The Frisco Kid. Rabbi Baruch Kohan will be in attendance. He taught Gene Wilder how to daven for that movie and wrote some of the music for it, too. It'll be great fun, a fabulous way to spend December 25th, very traditional for Jews, especially if you're Jewish. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Play us out this morning. Here's an Israeli phenomenon, Narkis, an observant Orthodox woman who performs in elaborate but modest costumes, singing Holechet Itcha. My friends, may you have a healthy week, God willing, a Shavua Tov, and a good week, we pray, of peace.
סוף לתאיות לחיפושי משמעויות אני יודעת שמצאתי אותך כל הנערות עוד ישטפו את הדמעות אני יודעת שמצאתי אותך שמע קולי קוראה את הדממה עושה משמעויות, אני יודעת שמצאתי אותך. כל הנאורות מזמן שתפו את הדמעות, אני יודעת שמצאתי אותך. ליבי כמו ספר פתוח, תראה אותי, ליבי כמו ספר פתוח, תראה אותי.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.